Ohio billionaire Les Wexner has contributed to many political campaigns over the years. Now that his ties to Jeffrey Epstein are in the spotlight, some Ohio politicians are rethinking those contributions. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, the ongoing repercussions of the Epstein files. Plus, a local congressional candidate faces a felony charge after a pedestrian crash. The Hyde Park Square developers make a new acquisition. And could the city of Cincinnati finally have a fix for its pension fund problem? Joining me now to get the news review started are Cincinnati Enquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller and Columbus Dispatch government reporter Jordan Laird. Thank you both for being here today. Jordan,
thanks for having us.
Yeah, I appreciate your being here. Jordan, Les Wexner's name has surfaced repeatedly in the Epstein files. Tell us about him briefly. I've seen him described as the wealthiest man in Ohio.
Yeah, he is definitely the wealthiest man in Ohio. He's a billionaire, so he's wealthy on the national stage and particularly influential in Ohio, where he resides in New Albany. He founded the L Brands, which was a retail empire at one point that included Victoria's Secret. He's extremely influential at Ohio State University, the Wexner Medical Center. So he's a big name, and he's been mentioned in the Epstein files that have been released in recent months a bunch of times because Jeffrey Epstein was his personal financial advisor for a number of years.
Jordan, what more do we know any more about that relationship between Les Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein?
Yeah, my colleagues have done a lot of deep dive reporting that I would recommend reading on that. The Epstein files and his deposition tell us about how he was his financial advisor for a number of years until Wexner cut ties with him after Epstein stole money from him. And Wexner has repeatedly said that he was conned. He didn't know anything about the sex crimes that Epstein was convicted of or accused of later. And he says that Epstein was dead to him after that. Did you want to chime in on anything there, Haley?
Yeah, it's, you know, worth noting too that while Wexner really downplayed their relationship this week, I mean, there are plenty of photos of them together out there, you know, at parties, things like that. And some of the documents, there's a reference to Wexner's children referring to Epstein as Uncle Jeffrey. So Wexner has said they weren't friends, but, you know, I think the documents and photos certainly challenge that assertion.
Yeah, and he was named as a co-conspirator at one point in FBI documents that have been released. Wexner's never been charged with anything. It's kind of murky, but that, I think, was one of the key things that have made politicians concerned about holding on to his campaign contributions.
Well, Haley, as I mentioned, Les Wexner has contributed lots of money over the years to political candidates in Ohio. Have his contributions been focused on a particular party?
Not really. We've seen him donate to Republicans and Democrats over the years, probably Republicans more so, but Wexner isn't really a Trump Republican, you know, decided to leave the Republican Party several years ago. So, you know, he certainly hasn't donated to Trump. And I think a lot of his donations to Ohio Republicans over the years have been the more traditional Republicans that we're accustomed to here, such as Governor Mike DeWine, Senator John Husted, some folks in the legislature, things like that. So, but he's also donated to, you know, Congresswoman Joyce Beatty and several local officials in the Columbus area, which is largely, you know, Democratic representation.
Well, Haley, I know some politicians in Ohio have made donations to charities that equal the contributions they've gotten from Les Wexner. Who are some of the big name elected officials who have done that?
We've seen Husted return some of those donations. Treasurer Robert Sprague has donated those contributions to charity. We've also seen U.S. Representatives Mike Carey and Joyce Beatty return their money, and I think some lawmakers as well. So, you know, to Jordan's point, there's a lot of concern or apprehension about Wexner right now. I mean, he's pretty politically toxic because of his ties to Epstein. And so I think, you know, a lot of these elected officials, many of whom are actively running for office in November, you know, want to distance themselves as much as possible.
Yeah, and I would add Dave Yost to that list of people who's given away donations, but there have definitely been some people on both sides of the aisle who have not given away their donations at this time.
And who are those, Jordan?
There's some people in Columbus, which might be less interesting to your readers, but the mayor of Columbus and the city attorney have received a number of donations over the years. Senator Moreno also has received a small amount. But he has not announced that he's giving that away. Governor DeWine is not running for anything again, but he has not said anything about giving away past donations. And yeah, that about covers the folks that have declined. Again, Wexner has not been charged with anything, so that has been some of their defense.
Well, Jordan, Les Wexner's wife, Abigail, also has donated lots of money to political candidates in her own name. How are politicians handling those donations from her?
It really depends. Some politicians are drawing a distinction between donations that Abigail gave and donations that Wexner gave. Like they're only giving away donations from Les and keeping the ones from Abigail, but others are just giving it all away. I believe Sprague received donations from both and gave all of it away.
Jordan, or maybe Haley, or maybe both of you, are there any prominent politicians in Ohio who are declining to say what they'll do, either in the state house or at the federal level?
I mean, Senator Moreno has not really spoken much about this. He, again, got a little bit of money, but hasn't said what he will do. I will also mention that Senator Husted was not one of the politicians that was out in front of this. Some politicians were very quick earlier this month. Senator Husted, after some reporting from other outlets and myself, eventually said he was going to donate what he had received in the past.
What about U.S. Former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown? I know he's running again as a Democrat. He's challenging Senator Husted to try to get his seat back in the Senate. Did he ever receive any donations from either Les or Abigail Wexner?
He
I could
has
imagine.
received money from Abigail Wexner, I believe about $10,000. He has not received any donations from Les Wexner that we're aware of. And at this point, he has not said that he will return the money from Abigail. Again, you know, he's one of those who's drawing that distinction between Abigail and Les. And so that's what we know about Brown at this point. And, you know, at the same time, he's really been hammering Husted hard for the donations that Husted received from Les Wexner and has highlighted the fact that Husted came up in the testimony that Wexner gave this week.
Well, let's talk about that, Haley. Les Wexner testified this week before a U.S. House committee. What can you tell us about his testimony or the questions that members of that committee asked him?
He denied that he ever knew anything about Epstein's crimes, you know, the things that he was accused of or convicted of. He said that he never saw Epstein getting massages or things like that. Or Wexner said he never received massages from underage girls. So he denied a lot of that. He also, as I mentioned earlier, really downplayed their relationship, said it was largely business, and, you know, said that he didn't think they were friends, despite, again, evidence that would suggest otherwise in a lot of these documents. He was also asked, I mentioned Husted, he was asked about donations that he gave to Husted and whether he ever asked Husted to lobby against the release of the Epstein files. Wexner said no. He also, a lot of the time, responded with, "I don't recall this, I don't recall that." He even at one point said that he couldn't remember if he had a prenup with his wife that Epstein helped with. So a lot of just, I don't recall.
Anything you want to add to that, Jordan?
Yeah, the deposition was 5.5 hours long. That it happened a couple days ago, but it was dropped online last night, kind of unexpectedly. The full thing is on YouTube, and you can watch it. But there weren't too many bombshell revelations, I would say. They asked him a lot of pointed questions. It was a lot of, no, I didn't know about that. I don't know anything about that. The birthday book that Wexner did sign came up.
Can you tell us more about that birthday book for people who haven't been following it as closely?
Yeah, this was kind of an infamous birthday book that Epstein got that a number of very famous people signed and sometimes drew crude drawings in. And Wexner was one of them. He drew a crude drawing in that birthday book. And he wrote in it that your friend, he signed it your friend, but he kind of downplayed that in the deposition when they asked about it.
Haley, you mentioned that he was asked questions about his contributions to Senator John Husted and whether he lobbied Senator Husted regarding the release of the Epstein files. Can you remind us about Senator Husted's votes related to the release of the Epstein files?
Yeah, so back last September, he opposed a procedural vote that would have allowed the process to move along in the Senate. But then in November, I believe, is when it was, when the final vote happened to release the files, Husted did vote in favor of releasing them. He has always said that his primary concern was ensuring that the documents are released in a way that protects the victims of Epstein.
So, Haley or Jordan, what are the next steps with this testimony that Les Wexner gave before this U.S. House committee? Or is there any follow-up that's expected? What's next with all that?
It's not totally clear, you know, this investigation and this probe by Congress, I think, is going to be continuing for some time. And I don't think they're done with Les Wexner. Democrats in Congress who flew to Ohio for the deposition this week held a news conference in New Albany, and they were very dissatisfied with Wexner's responses. They pretty much accused him of lying. And, you know, I don't be so because of that, I don't think they're going to let up on investigating him and questioning him and trying to learn more about his relationship with Epstein.
Is it unusual for a U.S. House committee to take their depositions on the road like this and go to someone's home to question them? Do you know, Haley?
It was a little surprising because he was set, as far as we knew, to testify in Washington, D.C. I believe, you know, there were some behind the scenes conversations with Wexner's attorneys and congressional officials. I believe Democrats said that it was Republicans on the committee who requested the venue change. So unclear why that was. Wexner is 88 years old. So perhaps there was an argument made about his age and ability to travel, but that's just speculation. We really don't know a lot about that decision.
Yeah, it was a little odd, and only Democratic representatives on the committee traveled to New Albany. The Republicans did not come.
So were the Republicans involved in the questioning?
Yeah, they had a questioner, but I believe that Republican Congress people did not make the flight.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah, I believe they had staff members handling their questioning, and they had staff members present for the hearing.
Okay. Well, we started this conversation talking about how Les Wexner is known for these big contributions, big political contributions. Are either of you seeing any big donations from either him or his wife, Abigail, in the Ohio governor's race?
I don't believe we've seen much on that front. I do think, as more time has gone on, Wexner's, you know, has let up a little on how much he's donating to political candidates, especially Republicans. So I'm not aware of him playing a big role in the current election.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Columbus Dispatch government reporter Jordan Laird and Cincinnati Enquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, a local congressional candidate is accused of leaving the scene of a pedestrian crash. This is Cincinnati Edition. We believe WVXU is a vital part of our community. If you place your trust in this station, please donate at WVXU.org. Or you can call 513-419-7155. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A local candidate for Congress faces a felony charge related to a pedestrian crash. Joining me now to explain is Cincinnati Enquirer, Hamilton County, and regional politics reporter Aaron Glenn. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Great to have you in the studio. Aaron, John Hancock is a Libertarian candidate. He is facing a felony charge in this pedestrian crash. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, this was in the early morning hours on December 3rd. Police say that he struck a 59-year-old woman on Hamilton Avenue and didn't stop afterwards, just continued on in his car. And prosecutors say that he lied to his insurance company afterward and said that he hit a tree.
Wow. Do we know how badly the pedestrian was hurt?
Well, in court documents, it does say that she suffered traumatic injuries. And the state has reserved the right to prosecute for murder if she passes as a result of those injuries.
Oh, gosh. Well, have you been able to reach him at all for a response or any kind of comment about all this?
I reached out to him through an email and a phone call to the information he provides on his campaign website. But he did not respond.
Okay. Well, he's one of a whole bunch of candidates who are running for Ohio's 1st congressional district. That's the seat that's currently held by Congressman Greg Landsman. Can you give us a rundown of the candidates and their parties?
Yes. So Landsman, a Democrat, faces a challenger in the Democratic primary. That's Damon Lynch IV, which is a name that's pretty well known in Cincinnati. His father and grandfather are both prominent Cincinnati activists. And then John Hancock is our only Libertarian candidate. Then there are 4 candidates in the Republican primary. So we have Eric Conroy, who's a former CIA officer, Dr. Stephen Urbeck, he's a 4th-generation dentist in Madeira, Rosemary Oglesby Henry, she founded a nonprofit called Rosemary's Babies for teenage mothers. And another candidate I don't know much about, Holly Adams from Powell, who doesn't seem to have done much campaigning and doesn't live in the district, which isn't a necessity, but I think something voters will be interested in.
Oh, yeah, that is interesting. So which of all these candidates seem to be the most active in terms of, you know, fundraising, advertising, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. I'm watching the endorsements shake out. Urbeck just was endorsed by the Warren County Republican Party. The district includes both Warren and Hamilton County. And then I believe Eric Conroy got an endorsement from Bernie Moreno this week. So we'll be watching to see what some of the high-profile Republicans, who they endorse in this race.
Okay. What else are you going to be watching for in this race as we get closer to the primary?
Well, definitely fundraising. That'll tell us a lot who's donating and how much money people are raising. And yeah, I think closer to when early voting starts in April, we'll have a better idea of who's a contender.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, in other political news, Tricia McLaughlin is leaving her job at the Department of Homeland Security. She grew up in Greater Cincinnati, right?
Yep, she's lived in Blue Ash and Montgomery. She went to Sycamore High School. And I think she's pretty active in Ohio politics before she started working for the Trump administration.
Well, and she's been in the spotlight as the spokesperson for President Trump's immigration agenda. Explain her role, what she's been doing.
Yeah, the Department of Homeland Security is maybe the agency that's been most high profile and most criticized in this second Trump administration. And McLaughlin is the chief mouthpiece of that department. So we've seen as... the DHS faced more criticism with ICE agents detaining children, ICE agents shooting and killing at least five people in recent months. McLaughlin has been first on the line to defend their actions. She was among the first to refer to Renee Good, who an ICE agent shot in Minneapolis, as a domestic terrorist. And so that's earned her some praise from the president and also some criticism from immigration advocates.
What has she told the Inquirer about the job she's doing and her approach to the job?
Yeah, she, I think, is a true believer. She thinks she's on, believes she's on the right side of history. She said she thinks people will look back in 10 to 15 years on the actions of the administration and think that that's what the country needed to do. She also said when she announced she was leaving that the job has been a meat grinder, and she's expressed a desire to move back to Cincinnati.
Yeah. Is leaving this job something she's been thinking about for a while, do you know?
She said she'd been thinking about it since December, and then her departure was delayed by the shootings in Minneapolis.
Hmm. Well, you know, as you mentioned, the Trump administration has come under intense scrutiny for its immigration enforcement, especially in Minneapolis. You talked about what she said about the Renee Good shooting, another federal agent killed Alex Preddy there. What else has she said about all that? Has she been as aggressive in her defense of federal agents on all these things?
Yes, she often comes back to, I mean, she told myself and my colleague David Ferrara that she thinks she is in the position to defend law enforcement officers in the line of duty. So she talks about their safety a lot. She repeats often that there's been a 1,000% increase in assaults on law enforcement officers, although the data has not backed that up.
I know you and your colleague David talked with supporters of hers. You also talked with critics. What did you hear from them?
I spoke to Lynn Tremonte, who founded the Ohio Immigrant Alliance, and she's been doing immigration advocacy work for 30 years. She said she's noticed the difference between the first Trump administration and this Trump administration, as she thinks there's a new lack of professionalism, that perhaps people are more careless with their words. She really took issue with throwing around the phrase domestic terrorist as a high-level official in the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah. She does have fans, though, as you mentioned, Trisha McLaughlin does, that the president has been a fan of hers, and even some local Republican leaders have been are fans, right?
Yes. So she used to be the chief spokesperson for the Ohio Republican Party, and I talked to Alex Triantafilou, who said that when he worked with her in his capacity as the Hamilton County Republican Party chair, she was always willing to work late nights. He said that she knew she would be a star when she was picked to lead Vivek Ramaswamy's presidential campaign.
Tell us a little bit more about her background in politics. Was she very active in Ohio before this big job in D.C.?
Well, she said she got inspired in politics her junior year of high school when she watched a debate between Connie Pillich and Shannon Jones. So very Ohio politics. And then she went on to study at the University of Maryland. She interned for two congressional representatives and then came back. She's worked on Mike DeWine's reelection campaign as spokesperson for the Ohio Republican Party and for Vivek Ramaswamy.
Hmm. Her husband is a political consultant, and his company did some work for the Department of Homeland Security, didn't it?
Yes. ProPublica reported that Ben Yoho, McLaughlin's husband, his company, the Strategy Group, received money from contracts for an ad campaign with the Department of Homeland Security. McLaughlin said she recused herself. She wasn't part of that decision. But that definitely has drawn some scrutiny.
Yeah. Can you tell us any more about what she said about that contract?
Well, she said that her role does not involve picking the subcontractors for the Department of Homeland Security, and that she and Yoho never spoke about it. I think ProPublica and some Democratic lawmakers have called for an investigation into the contracts because it does seem unusual for someone with close ties to a department to be awarded ad contracts.
Mm-hmm. What has Trisha McLaughlin said about what she'll be doing next? Has she given any hints about that?
She told us to stay tuned. I know that she said she and her husband want to move back to the Cincinnati area to start a family. I asked her if she'd plans to run for office, and she didn't say.
Okay. Well, I guess we will stay tuned, as she suggested. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer, Hamilton County, and regional politics reporter Erin Glenn. Thank you so much for your time today, Erin.
Thank you.
Up next, does Cincinnati finally have a plan to resolve its pension debt? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. For years, the city of Cincinnati has been facing a major financial problem, an underfunded pension system for its retired workers. Could there finally be a fix? Joining me now to explain all this and discuss the latest with the Hyde Park Square redevelopment are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca and Chris.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, why is the city pension fund in such bad shape?
That is a great question.
Thanks, Becca.
So the basically what's wrong with the pension system is that there's not enough money in the future projections to cover benefits for all of the retirees. So this is a pension system that covers many city employees, notably, not the police department or the fire department. They have their own separate pension systems. So this is basically looking into the future, although there's enough money to cover current people who have retired from city work and are collecting benefits, you know, projecting out 10, 20, 30, 40 years, the pension could be as low as, you know, 15-18% funded, which means there's not enough money to cover those benefits. Obviously, these employees have earned those benefits. They paid into the system during their time. And so this is a huge question mark in terms of, or has been until this week, a huge question mark in terms of how the city is going to handle this. And it's obviously a huge problem for the city budget overall as well, because the city has to put a certain amount of current employee salaries, a certain percentage of salaries into the fund. That's money that can't be spent on other things in the general fund, lots of other things that the city has to pay for. So I don't know that I actually fully answered your question,
nope.
But these are the kind of big issues that the city has been dealing with.
Yeah. You wanted to add to that, Chris?
Yeah. You know, going back, let's go back in history. Let's get in the DeLorean for a moment. So back in the 90s, one reason that this is that the city's pension is facing this deficit is that the council at the time basically boosted the benefits. They made the benefits better than they had been. And then in subsequent years and decades, they did not properly fund what they had increased employee benefits. When they increased the employee benefits, I think it was in the 90s, the pension fund was actually in pretty good shape. But they were too generous or they were, if you're an employee, it wasn't too generous. They did not fund the generosity enough. And so I think that's kind of the root cause. There's also the 2008 Great Recession. They didn't recover very quickly from that. That was a problem. And so there have been these little steps along the way. But kind of the going back to the root cause was the enhanced benefits and not funding them properly.
Well, Chris, didn't former Mayor John Cranley and the city council at that time reach a deal in 2015 to fully fund the pension? What happened with that?
Yeah, they sure did. And a couple of things happened with that. You know, at the time, I remember the Mayor Cranley, you know, when we talk about pension funding, we talk about it as a percentage that the city has to pay of its payroll. So, you know, let's say the city had $1 million in payroll. You know, the deal that they struck back then required them to spend 16.25% of the overall payroll. And so they believed at that time that would be sufficient to bring it to full funding, as well as a massive capital injection of more than $200 million that they took out of the health fund, which was and remains, you know, well and fully funded. The issues that arose were, you know, many. You know, the investment returns did not hit their targets. The city assumes it's going to make 7.5% on the pension fund from its investments, which is one way that they fund the pensions. And then another thing happened was the Social Security Administration revised its projection of life expectancy. And so pension funds across the country had to do the same thing to be fiduciary, you know, to be responsible to the financial needs of the pension. So those are a couple of reasons that has kind of not worked out.
So, Becca, what is Mayor Puerval proposing as a fix to this?
Well, and to be clear, this is a deal that has been negotiated as an amendment to the agreement that we've mentioned already that was reached between Cranley and folks that back then. So Mayor Pierville announced this, but he didn't personally put the plan together. So just to be clear on that, it's a little bit complicated. It involves some one-time cash influx into the system. So one is $50 million that would go into the pension fund immediately. The source of that funds is it's money that the city had set aside just in case people who were working from home during the pandemic, working from home outside the city, had paid gotten a paid income tax and requested a refund. All of the litigation related to that, which obviously it's been a few years by now, that's all been resolved. So there's no risk anymore that folks will be requesting that refund. So that $50 million is available immediately. It does require council approval to put into the pension fund. Another $50 million would be paid into the fund in staggered payments over the next roughly 20 years. And these would come from several restricted funds in the city. This is a little bit complicated because those restricted funds like Greater Cincinnati Waterworks and the Metropolitan Sewer District of Greater Cincinnati, those are funds that are supposed to stay within those departments and be spent on the benefit of those departments. The argument here is that the future retirees from those departments will benefit from the pension. And so that's kind of the argument that they're making there. So those departments, to be clear, already are paying the salary percentage. That's sometimes a misconception that I hear. They are still paying the same amount as other city employees. And then the other is an increased contribution by percentage of salaries, both from the city, which will pay now starting a minimum of 19.25% of employer salaries. That's above the current minimum of 16.25%. But it's worth noting the city has already been above that threshold the last couple of years, thanks to city council approving a higher amount. So the city is currently putting 18.5% of salaries into the fund. It will increase to a minimum of 19.25%. There's a maximum amount that's maybe too much in the weeds to get into at the moment. They have also negotiated that current employees will increase how much they are paying into the pension system. Currently, they're paying 9% of their salaries. That will increase to 10% eventually, but in an incremental stage, so 0.25% each year for the next 4 years.
Okay. Well, Mayor Pierville says current projections show the pension would increase the percentage of funding to roughly 75% within the next 10 years and would reach 100% funding by 2046.
The work that council did to strengthen the pension over the past 4 years created the conditions necessary by not just improving its health, but also improving the trust amongst the stakeholders to the settlement agreement, which empowered and allowed the administration over the last year in a confidential federal mediation to hammer out this compromise and this plan moving forward.
Chris, what if the city runs into some of the same problems that it had over the past 10 years since the deal that former Mayor Cranley made?
Well, they have to increase it to 21% and change to try to deal with those problems. It's important to note it here, that even these percentages we talk about, 21% is kind of the high point. That's not what actuaries who examine the system say should be spent. They say in the 30% range and more. And that has been the case for a long, long time. And the elected officials look at that and they say, well, that's not sustainable. We would have to cut services. We would have to make an impact on people's, what people notice from city government in order to reach that level. So I think that's important to note as well. However, the fact that the council did spend more money on pensions when it kind of didn't have to, at least at that point, is pretty notable. You don't see that very often in government. Elected officials don't like to spend money on pensions because they would rather spend it on projects and things that get them votes and that sort of thing. So, the fact that this has kind of all happened in the wake of the pandemic and the major influx of cash from the federal government to cities, I think that helped this along as well, because council didn't have to make tough choices about cutting spending during those years, because the federal government said, look, we know you're really in trouble here. So, we're going to give cities and counties and local governments a lot of money to stay afloat during the pandemic.
Well, here's Mayor Pierville talking about why this is so vital.
This is important for not just the fiscal health of the city. It's important not just for the retirees, but it's also important for our credit rating. one of the biggest liabilities holding us back was this unfunded gap with our pension. Now, with this plan in place and with the investment of $50 million today, an additional $50 million over time, as well as our increased employer contribution, we will have a much stronger case to be made to have a better credit rating, which will empower us to leverage bonding in a way that we have been handcuffed by in the past.
Chris, in the most radio-friendly terms you have, why is the city, explain why the city's credit rating is such a big deal and what a better credit rating could mean for the city.
Try to think of it like borrowing money to buy your house, right? If you've got terrible credit, if you, you know, spent more than you took in, if you have a bunch of credit card debt, they're going to look at that and say, you're going to pay a higher rate to buy, you know, to buy your house. If you don't do those things, if you don't have a lot of debt, you're going to get a better interest rate. And so that's what the city is kind of angling for here. I was trying to remember whether and look up quickly whether the city's credit rating improved after the Cranley deal in 2015. I don't recall, but that'll be one of the major interesting questions is whether the credit rating agencies in New York buy this, you know, think that this is actually a usable plan. They have not really – they've not downgraded the city in recent years, so – but they have consistently said this pension debt is a problem for you guys over the long term.
Becca, what does this whole thing mean for the benefits that retirees get and that current city employees can expect to get? Is this going to reduce benefits in any way?
There's nothing in this agreement that changes benefits in any way. It doesn't change the age at which you're eligible for benefits. It doesn't change, what benefits employees would receive. Those obviously could be negotiated separately from this. This doesn't cover any of that. City Manager Sherlong did send an email to all current city employees on Tuesday morning informing them of the proposed changes that they're seeking and assuring them that their benefits will not be reduced.
So, Chris, what's next with this? It needs city council approval, I guess. And if it gets that approval, will this fix the city's pension fund problem?
I think the mayor has said that he easily has the nine votes that he needs. And I think it will be approved in the next, is it next week, Becca?
Maybe. It's on the agenda for next week, but then it goes to a federal judge after that, right? who has the final say.
Yeah, U.S. District Judge Michael Barrett has kind of the final, he's been presiding over this case for, more than 10 years. So it has to be approved by the court. Is it going to fix it? That's a question TBD. In 2015, we kind of thought they were on the path to doing it, and it kind of quickly turned the other way. So the old saw, only time will tell, Lucy.
Okay. Well, let's switch gears here just a little bit. Chris, the developers behind the Hyde Park Square redevelopment that we talked about so much last year.
We're
going to keep talking about it. They have acquired more property there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they bought a building on the south side of Hyde Park Square that is owned by Granite Properties. If you're thinking about Hyde Park Square, there's a fire station, and then they bought the building that is basically to the right of it, if you're just looking at the fire station. That gives them all but two properties on the south side of Hyde Park Square, between just to the east of Edwards Road. The ones that they don't have are the fire station, which I don't think is really on the table, and a property owned by a man named Lee Robinson, which is a one-story building.
Is that building going to figure into this development group's overall plan? Do we know how this fits into the big picture?
We're not certain yet. The building they just bought from Granite Properties, it could add to the footprint of the development. The developer says that for now, that building will remain operating. It's got people living in the first and second, or I'm sorry, the second and third floors. And there is retail on the first floor. And so that is going to continue to operate that way at this point. We don't know the details of any leases there that might play into, whether anything can be done with that building. But it's another piece of the potential puzzle there on Hyde Park Square.
What's the latest with that Hyde Park Square redevelopment? Have you seen any new plans for that?
No, I have not seen new plans. We did see plans late last year at a community council meeting. The developer kind of presented some updated plans with a hotel put back, and then some other alternative plans with no hotel. They asked the community council to basically say which one they liked better. The community council at that time decided they didn't want to do any votes on that. So What we are basically still waiting for is for the developers, who I should name here, PLK Communities, the Loring Group, and North Point Group, to present a new plan to the city. And we don't quite know when that will happen. We've presumed that it will happen this year, though.
So are those developers still in talks with community members about all this?
I think they always have conversations. I'm not sure how serious they are and all of that. Listeners probably remember that this was a major issue in the city council race, and all of the people that voted for the development and voted against it, as the community members will tell you, all won basically re-election. So the balance of power did not change as a result of this issue.
Okay. Well, Becca, I want to come back to you. The city of Cincinnati set a goal of reducing carbon emissions 50% by 2030 and reaching full carbon neutrality by 2050. Is the city on track?
The answer is yes, with an asterisk. So the city is at nearly 40% reduction in carbon emissions compared to 2006, which is the baseline year. But the asterisk is that the data trails by a couple of years. And so the last couple of years are a little bit of an unknown. So a lot has changed in the energy environment in the last couple of years, especially the last, I'd say, 12 months in particular. So it is possible that that will change, the data that we have. But at the moment, the city is on track to reach both of those goals, which is the 50% reduction by 2030 and full carbon neutrality by 2050.
What role has federal funding been playing in all this work, all this progress the city's been making?
What's interesting, so the Green Cincinnati Plan is on kind of a five-year cycle, so it is updated every 5 years. It was most recently updated in 2023, and that was a really remarkable time. So it was kind of in preparation in 2022, right as the Inflation Reduction Act was coming online, and other kind of major federal-level funding availability. So the city applied for and was awarded almost $50 million in federal funding for not just carbon reduction, to be clear, but the Green Cincinnati Plan sustainability goals in general. There are well over 100 goals in the Green Cincinnati Plan. So lots of federal funding was headed to Cincinnati. And then there was a presidential administration change and quite a bit of halting of a lot of that funding. So that's been reduced down to really about $18 million that is currently available. That number could go up as some litigation goes through the courts, as the city tries to fight to keep some of the money that was awarded on the federal level.
And remind me, it's $18 million and they were expecting how much?
Over 50 million.
Oh, wow.
Over
okay.
50 million.
Big yeah. reduction. Yeah.
So, less than half. And that's just money that was awarded to the city of Cincinnati. That's not including federal funding that was awarded to community groups or nonprofits or others in the greater Cincinnati area. I'm not sure what that total number is if we kind of broaden the scope a little bit. Big changes in the amount of funding. Now, the city officials will say that they were doing this work for many, many years without that level of federal support. And so that will not stop them from continuing to do the work on this project. But it is significant that changed so much just in a period of, 14 months.
Yeah. We talk a lot on this show about the energy that data centers and AI use, and utility costs are increasing for households too. Is the city focused on energy as part of this work?
Absolutely. And again, a lot has changed in the couple of years since the Green Cincinnati Plan was last updated, something I think we've talked about on Cincinnati Edition, although I'm blanking if we have. But the move that council made and the Planning Commission made to do an interim development control overlay related to data centers. So basically, there's no definition for data centers in Cincinnati zoning code. So there's this effort to let's pause, get a little bit of extra oversight for data centers that want to come into the city or existing data centers that want to expand. And during that pause, they will do a zoning study and try to determine, what are the factors that we need to consider that will include impact on the local energy grid and potential impact on energy costs, utility costs. We're talking both electricity and water. So that's one thing that the city is doing.
And I will mention, we're going to talk more about that on Cincinnati Edition on Monday.
Perfect.
Yes.
So I will tune in to that for sure.
Yes.
Other things that the city is working on more specific to the Office of Environment and Sustainability, which oversees the Green Cincinnati Plan, is things like trying to make homes more energy efficient. So using less energy, that puts less stress on the energy grid. It also saves money for folks who are seeing these much higher costs for the cost of their utilities. disabilities. One of the challenges there is, you know, you can have incentive programs and things like that for single family homeowners who live in their own home and want to do some energy upgrades. It's more difficult for multifamily properties where, you know, the tenant pays the utility bill, but they so there's not much incentive for the landlord to invest money into making their properties more energy efficient. So that's something that the city is kind of looking at, and how can they do some financial incentives or other incentives for landlords to make their buildings more utility friendly for their renters.
Have they said anything more to you about what those incentives might look like? I think that's a really interesting push there.
That is. I don't have any details on that at this time. I think some of those are early stages. There are some existing programs like Warm Up Cincy that I think is more focused on renters than on landlords. But there are some existing programs, but I don't have details.
Okay. Well, there is a lot more in Becca's story on our website, wvxu.org, her conversation with city official Ollie Kroner about the Green Cincinnati Plan and where the city stands on that. So I would advise all of our listeners to check that out and be sure to tune in Monday. We're going to talk for the full hour about data centers, the state legislation that is being discussed and debated and proposed about data centers in Columbus, and then, of course, what's happening in Cincinnati. So you won't want to miss that. And on Tuesday, we're going to have Duke Energy on the program to talk about energy costs and your utility bills. So don't want to miss those. Be sure to tune in. I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today. Really appreciate your being here.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts, even on YouTube now. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you all have a great weekend.